Imagine the situation in the astronomy community in 1968. A graduate student doing some ordinary measurements of radio stars has come across a phenomenon that is truly extraordinary. A star is blinking on and off 10 times per second. How could this be? How could a star turn its radio emissions on and off so rapidly? In any star, there exists a fire of incredible temperature, hotter than the largest furnace on Earth. How could it turn on, then off, over and over again? Astronomers all over the world begin to look for other pulsars. And sure enough, such objects are everywhere in the skies. In the year following the initial discovery, 27 pulsars are discovered. All, however, can only be detected by their radio waves. These radio sources emit relatively small amounts of energy. A race begins. Would anyone locate a pulsar which emitted so much energy that it could be observed with ordinary light? If an optical pulsar could be found, it would be a major help in solving the pulsar problem. Some of the most famous astronomers enter the race equipped with the world's largest telescopes. The winners, however, are two unknown young scientists who had only recently met. What's more, they had never before operated a telescope. This is their story. Don't try to learn about pulsars from this tape. Try to learn about science itself and the people who practice science. Pay attention to the procedures, not the particular facts. Listen carefully, and you will hear more than the excitement of a moment of discovery. You will hear people who want the discovery to be real, but who do not hide from the possibility that it is all a mistake. In this tape, John Cock and Michael Disney describe the events leading up to their discovery. Philip Morrison, professor of physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, gives background information and his own personal recollections. But that is not all. Incredible as it may seem, a tape recorder installed to keep track of the data also recorded all the conversation on the night of the discovery. The scientists only wanted to note the steps in their observations, but in fact the microphone heard everything they said. As you listen to excerpts of that tape, you will be witness to an actual discovery, and you will share the excitement of this historic evening. Here is Philip Morrison.
In 68, January, February that year, I remember myself meeting at the airport a friend who had just returned from Great Britain, an astronomer. And he said, "Have you heard the latest?" And I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "They've got something that pulses every second. A stellar signal that pulses every second." I said, "Oh, it couldn't be true." And yes, he says, "Absolutely true. They announced it recently. They've studied it for about 5 or 6 months. It's extraordinary." And that was the announcement of the discovery of what we now call a pulsar, which was announced by the group at Cambridge University in England, first to discover it, very early in the winter of 1968, as I recall, about January or February. Indeed, the graduate student Jocelyn Bell had first picked up the first pulsar several months before. But in Cambridge, they sat on these results for several months because the whole thing was so extraordinary and so unexpected that they didn't want to release it until they had a chance to confirm it. The reason, of course, is quite simple. We think of the stars quite sensibly as being, well, we say the fixed stars, as being eternal, long-lived, everlasting. And even though we know that's not 100% true, that the star sometimes explodes a little bit, making a nova, or explodes disruptively, flinging itself apart entirely, making a supernova, still, those are not really fast events from a human timescale. If they take a few seconds or a day, that would be remarkable for a star. You don't see much happening on the stars in a second. The reason for that is very understandable. A star is very big. And anything that happens, especially if we know it by means of light or radio waves, which are almost the only ways we know anything about the distant stars, the effect must come to us traveling at the speed of light. If your whole sun went off instantly, it would take a second for its light to die away, because the light from the farthest part around the edge of the sun comes to us a second later, nearly half a second, than the light from the front of the sun. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is true in the stars, and that's why we never expect anything to vary on the stars any quicker than seconds. And yet, these people heard unmistakably from some middle-distance stars radio signals that went tick, 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 like that, very sharp ticks, lasting a fraction of a second, repeated every half second or so. It was interesting to hear the audio recording, a tape recording, of the radio astronomer's clicks when he records such a pulsar. So we knew something remarkable was going on, and people gave it a name, pulsar. By late summer of that same year, of course, the whole astronomical community was galvanized looking at it, and everybody with a radio telescope began looking in radio waves for pulsars, here, there, and everywhere, because it was clear they were there for the finding, and the number discovered grew by leaps and bounds. I don't remember how many, but certainly there were dozens by the end of the year. This is a story from the vintage year of 1968.
John Cock.
Disney's a very outgoing type. And as it turns out, we both arrived in Tucson about the same time, in the middle of August, in 68, I guess that was. And we were both staying at the same motel before, you know, preparatory, while we were looking for a more permanent place to live. And so, as I recall, my wife and I met Disney and his wife at the swimming pool at the motel and started talking about what we were doing in Tucson. It turned out that we were both astronomers and we're both going to be at Stewart Observatory.
Michael Disney.
And I felt completely out of my depth there, and with all these clever people rushing up and down mountains and measuring real stars and things and telescopes. And I was a pure theoretical astronomer, and I didn't really know what a real telescope looked like.
We had both thought that it would be a good thing to get experience of a telescope just as a thing in itself. And we had also thought from time to time about doing something really relative to pulsars. Well, everyone was interested in them, I suppose, when they were discovered. It immediately became a very, very popular thing to try and work on. What we proposed to do first was to search known white dwarfs for optical pulsations.
Well, the first thing we did was to apply for some observing time, which, much to our amazement, we got a little bit of. That's three or four nights on this very, rather small telescope, a 36-inch telescope at Stewart. These type of experiments were usually done by people with colossal telescopes and all sorts of modern equipment. In fact, we would never have got time, I don't think, being complete novices on a decent large telescope. So it was kind of fortunate for us that we did have a small telescope. So they said, oh, well, they'll only waste two or three nights on a small telescope anyway. Mm-hmm. It was very funny, really, because they thought, first of all, it was a huge joke that two theoreticians were going to observe anyway. I mean, it's a kind of stock joke they have in all observatories, that anybody who uses a pen and pencil and his brain and mathematics is totally hopeless with his fingers, and is bound to put his foot through or his fingers through all the equipment and so on and can't observe. So there were jokes all around the observatory, which we took in a fairly good spirit because we kind of agreed with everybody. But a couple of things completely changed the whole outlook of what we were doing. First of all, a paper arrived from Australia. An English astronomer out there called Mike Large had discovered another pulsar which was near a supernova remnant. Now, it had been predicted all along that the place you would find a neutron star would be close to or inside a supernova remnant. And more importantly, this new pulsar that Mike Large had discovered was a very, very fast one. It pulsed on and off 11 times a second.
That made everyone realize that you couldn't turn a whole star's radio emission on and off that fast, no matter what you did. And the only answer, and there was an answer available, and everybody began to believe that then, was that the star that was doing the radio pulsing, that the pulsar must be a very tiny star indeed. We knew of two small kinds of star. Let me call them condensed stars. That's what we tend to call them. There's a class of star called a white dwarf. White dwarf matter is the most condensed form of normal matter with nuclei and electrons that we know about. And if you make a star out of white dwarf matter, the star shrinks down to the size of a planet a few thousand miles across. And so such a star might somehow emit pulses, maybe a second or a half second, or just possibly a tenth of a second, but hardly make very sharp ones that were sharp compared to the tenth of a second spacing. And so the possibility that a white dwarf was the source of the pulsars that we heard was still, I think, as I recalled it, I still thought it was an open question, but it didn't look very good. Because, of course, there's another kind of matter and another kind of condensed star that goes with it. And that is what people call a neutron star. It is one big nucleus. The electrons have disappeared entirely, or almost entirely. And in their place is nothing but nuclear matter. But not a single nucleus, but nuclei fused together. So you have one nucleus as big, well, as massive as the Sun, but of course enormously condensed. Little condensed objects as massive as maybe one-half or one-fifth or one-tenth the star they started from, but only as big, no longer as big as a star or as big as a planet, but only as big as a mountain. And of course spinning, because everything spins, and as you know, as you make something smaller, it tends to spin more and more rapidly. And now that thing, you see, it only takes light 10,000th of a second across that star. And so that could be expected to make quick pulses.
But pretty well convinced people, and convinced us too, that pulsars were indeed not white dwarfs, but rather neutron stars. And then finally, I think maybe a month later, the discovery of the radio pulses from the general direction of the Crab Nebula was announced.
What was more, they discovered that this pulsar was pulsing about 30 times a second. So it was even faster than the one that discovered in Australia.
People were talking about it, wondering what in the world these things were and why. And everyone was being rather astounded at the apparent connection with the Crab Nebula.
And the reason why everybody's excited was because it looked as if pulsars were the first actual sight of something which people had been prognosticating for 30 years, namely neutron stars. That's to say, objects which are made out of incredibly dense material, so dense that the usual analogy is that a teaspoonful of it would weigh a billion tons.
Well, this was what really pinned it down for us, because what we then did was we went to do a more thorough study of the Crab Nebula ourselves to see if we could pinpoint where within the nebula the pulsar might be.
Radio telescopes don't have very good directional resolution, and in fact the uncertainty was so great that it could have been literally thousands of stars. So before we could look for a particular place, we got to make some guess, do some detective work as to where we should look. And it seemed the logical place to start off is to look right in the center of the nebula. I mean, what's supposed to happen in a supernova explosion is that once upon a time it was a star, and then the center of it collapsed to this neutron star, and the outside is completely blown off.
As it turns out, at the center of the Crab Nebula, there's a double star, and Bata star is the south preceding component of that double star, and precedes it in its motion across the sky as the Earth turns. And we found that Bata star was indeed a very peculiar object in its own right. It had a continuous spectrum in the optical, and no absorption or emission lines of any sort, and had been presumed by Bata and by Minkowski to be the core left over from the supernova explosion that produced the Crab Nebula. So what we did was we said, well, why don't we make some observations of Bata's star itself to see whether or not it might be pulsing at the same period that the radio pulsar had been discovered to pulse at. I remember asking a couple of very well-known, very prominent astrophysicists, asking them whether or not they felt that a pulsar would ever be detected optically. And they all were very, very negative about it. And they said, oh, no, I doubt very much that will ever happen.
In fact, looking for pulsars in the optical is rather a complicated experiment. It requires all sorts of equipment which we had no idea about at the time. And Ray Wyman, who was one of the senior scientists at the observatory, suggested to us that there was an ideal piece of equipment already in the observatory belonging to Don Taylor, Don Taylor's a bit of an electronic wizard. This little piece of equipment he had, which is a kind of miniature computer, you can plug the signals off in from the telescope onto it at once, and you can look at the screen, and you can see all these little dots which show the signals coming in, the lights coming in, and you can watch it climbing up the screen, and if it's pulsing, you'll see a little wave developing in the middle of the screen.
They knew the timing from the radio work, 33.2 milliseconds or something of the sort. Knowing that number was indispensable, they superposed what was the light that was coming, the weak light that was coming, by cutting it every 33 milliseconds and putting the light, folding it up every 33 milliseconds, folding it up electronically, so it added up and the pulse slowly grew out of the noise. Because in a single pulse, their telescope didn't get enough photons in to make a smooth curve at all. It just got jagged, noisy appearance. It was just the superposition that made it possible.
So we decided to go in with Don Taylor, which was a hell of a good thing. We went up the mountain one night and took a photograph of the Crab Nebula so that we could pinpoint all these little stars that were in the center of it. They're far too faint for us to see with a tiny little telescope like a 36-inch telescope. So what we were going to have to do was to take a photograph in which you can see these stars, and then using a sort of automatic guider, it's called, it's a thing for setting the telescope off from a star that you can see to a piece of sky where the stars are too faint to see. You can do it automatically by steering the telescope to the place you want.
We all went, all three of us went up to Kitt Peak, and Don Taylor and Bob McAllister, who is the night assistant, worked around with the electronics, I remember, while Disney and I turned our attention to the telescope itself.
The observatory in Arizona is on a very remote mountain peak inside an Indian reservation. And up on the top of the mountain, you live in a little dormitory where you cook for yourself. So we had to get all our food, load all the equipment into the car at the university, and then drive out across the desert, and then right up the mountain, this very spectacular winding road up the side of the mountain to the very top where the observatory is situated. And then Don, who was keeping a very close guard on all his equipment in case we did anything with it, carried it all up, and we helped him up into the dome. I should say the telescope we were using was an old-fashioned Newtonian telescope, where the light comes down and you have to work at the top end of it. So you climb up right underneath the dome, so you're working up right up against the stars, as it were, looking down inside the telescope, the top end of the telescope. And all our equipment was up on a little mezzanine floor, which was up beside the top of the telescope. Well, we got it all set up, and we cooked ourselves a meal, and then we went out and into the dome. And I didn't realize to begin with how cold it could be observing, so there I was sitting around in a sports jacket and freezing to death and regretting it like mad. It's very, very, very dark inside, of course, as it has to be, and so you lunge around with a torch in your hand. Of course, you're not supposed to turn on a torch during the critical moments, because even the smallest piece of torchlight can ruin the observations, ruin the observer's eyesight, and generally foul things up. So there you are, walking around up on this high platform with no guardrail on it, I might say, hoping to God you're not going to step off the edge, and hoping that you're not going to bang your head on all the sharp projections of the telescope and so on. And then Don got all his electronics ticking over, and all the dials were reading the right thing, the lights were flashing, and the voltages were all correct. And what we were doing was trying to learn to set the telescope on the right place in the Crab, the very center of it, where Bardas Star was. And so we spent the whole of the first night making a bit of a hash of this.
Yeah, well, it was very exciting, but I was quite nervous, and I had this distinct feeling of wondering really what in the hell I was doing there. Now, the second night we actually did some observations.
John and I were doing two things: looking through the telescope, measuring off distances, and calculating exactly where we were in the nebula. And about 11 o'clock that night, I think, everything was going, we were set on the central object, we were all quite excited, and we were sure everything was all right, and then we switched it all on and watched this screen with the with all these little dots climbing up it. What we were looking for was that several of these dots should race out in front of the others, because this would tell us it was a pulse of light coming from this pulsar.
The Krebs pulsar has two pulses in it, a big one, the primary one, and a shorter, fatter secondary pulse. They come more or less spaced evenly between each other. The radio pulse looks like that, and so we had thought probably that's what the optical pulse would look like too.
Well, for a few moments we were quite excited because we really thought that Baader's star would be the place to find this pulsar, and in fact there was no sign of a pulsar at all. So we were all a little bit let down. And Don decided that he had to go back to the university in Tucson, so the next day he showed us how to work all the equipment. By now we were pretty familiar with it and realized it really wasn't as terrifying as it all looked at first. And so on the third night, John and I observed on our own. We weren't exactly on our own at all. In fact, we had Bob McAllister, you know, prevented us from making a lot of mistakes, and was actually working some of the electronic equipment for us. We repeated essentially what we'd done the previous night, and we didn't find any pulsar at all.
I do remember feeling pretty discouraged about the whole thing. Of course, we weren't very optimistic to begin with, or at least I wasn't. And so I wasn't feeling as discouraged as I would have if I'd had really high hopes.
We had two more nights to go, and then it turned out they were both cloudy, so there was nothing we could do anyway. And then it just happened that the person who was observing after us, Bill Tift his name was, he said that his wife was sick and he couldn't come observing. There were a couple more days we could have. So we decided, well, anyway, we might as well use them.
The next 2 days then were spent more or less walking around the mountain under the clouds trying to think what to do next. Until then I remembered that it would probably be a good thing to go and recheck the calculations that I did.
And when I came up the mountain on the in the evening of the next day, John and I cooked dinner, and he told me something very interesting. Because the Earth is moving around the Sun, the actual period, the apparent period of these pulses from the pulsar changes. Earth is moving either towards the pulsar or away from it. When the Earth is moving towards the pulsar, the pulses will appear to come more quickly than they would normally, and when we're moving away, they'd rather come more slowly. It's like a train coming towards you, going the note drops. It's what's called a Doppler effect. And so we'd had to make corrections to the known period, the radio period of the pulse. And John said, look, he said, we've made a mistake doing this. And so we sat down over the kitchen table in the observatory and spent an hour going over all these calculations again, and by Joe, that's exactly what we had done. We'd made an error in making this correction. So we hadn't really looked for the pulsar at all, because our timing gear had been set at the wrong period.
It was an error of 2 pi, actually. I had mistakenly approximated the sine of an angle by the angle divided by 2 pi. Well, I felt like a real idiot. And I was a bit dumbfounded, because now, having gone through all that time to make these observations, now I was faced with the prospect of having to go back and do the whole darn thing over again. Again, with a feeling that it was utterly futile anyway. And that really, the whole thing was a waste of time.
So Bob McAllister, the night assistant, John Clark and I went up into the dome, reset the timing gear at the new period that we'd worked out, and then we set back to go right through the whole procedure again, starting to look at Baader's star, the south preceding star.
On the night of January 15, 1969, at Steward Observatory, John Cock, Michael Disney, and Bob McAllister adjusted the timing gear and set the 36-inch telescope on Baader's star. They were unaware that while they were observing, they were also tape-recording their own voices. On this part of the tape, you will hear portions of that candid recording, as well as more excerpts from the interviews with John Cock and Michael Disney, and closing remarks by Philip Morrison. The first voice you will hear is Michael Disney.
We all crouched in front of the telescope, at least in front of the electronics, because the telescope runs itself once you've set it correctly. We all crouched in front of the electronics, looking at this little screen, watching these green dots coming up the middle.
This next observation will be observation number 18.
You've got a bleeding pulse here. Hey. Wow.
You don't suppose that's really it, do you? It can't be.
It's right bang in the middle of the period. But, I mean, right bang in the middle of the scale. It really looks something from here at the moment.
Hmm.
And it's growing, too. It's growing at the side a bit, too.
God, it is, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, God, yeah, it looks like a bleeding pulse. It's growing, John.
It is.
Look.
It is. You're right.
We saw the pulse come up almost immediately. And we were both Disney and I were completely dumbfounded by the whole thing.
I shall never forget that, because it was right in the middle of the screen. It seemed, on the very first run that we made with this new timing, it just seemed incredible. And I can remember crouching in front of it and my eyes popping out in stalks and saying, "My God, there's a bleeding pulsar out there." And John was swearing to himself, and Bob McAllister was, I don't think quite what he made of it. None of us really believed it.
God. I hate to believe it right now, though. Well, we're up to 2,000 counts. We're now at 750, 700.
It's really building up. Look at that.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
There's not one left behind now. See, look. Not one of those dots left behind there.
Oh, God. Yeah. Wow. We'll stop after...
This is where it would be. We were expecting
stop,
it to...
get out of phase, and then start over again and see if it, after this runs over.
There's a second something over here.
Well, we expect two... a small pulse and a large pulse, remember?
Mm-hmm. Right. I wouldn't be sure of this one, but... Yeah. That's a bleeding pulse.
It is, isn't it? God.
God, believe it. Don't believe it until we get a second one.
I won't believe it until we get the second one, and until the thing is shifted somewhere else.
God, go on, just come look at it down here.
Perfect.
This is a historic moment.
Yeah. I hope it's a historic moment. We'll know when we take another reading, and if that spike there is again right in the middle. See, that spike is right in the middle, and that scares me.
We decided to try to just determine whether or not it was an electronic artifact or it was a real thing. And we'll switch all the electronics off and switch it on again.
This is run number 19 on SP Star, on South SP Star. Run away. Get back here and do some of my paperwork. Okay, I'm caught up out of the road here.
We got Don's number. Beginning.
Yeah.
It's moved over.
Yeah, it has, hasn't it?
My God, it's still there. It's as good as it was, or better than it was last
it's
time.
It's still right in the middle of the screen.
No, it isn't. It's moved to the right. See, look.
I may have to turn it down. Sorry about that.
It's growing.
That's it. My God, we got it.
Yeah.
I think the best way to look at these things is forget the dots, just look underneath here, mm-hmm. with the dots at the bottom.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Huh? Yeah, it's much clearer then.
It disturbs me that it's right in the middle of the screen.
It isn't, John.
It's
look.
It's moved a little bit, yeah.
It's moved to the right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Hey, Bob, was the frequency generator is still going all the time, isn't it? Well, that's good. It should
hopefully.
Be in the same place. Because the frequency generator is still going.
I know, it should be. It should
wait,
be.
No, it's not.
If you get the right frequency, then it'll be more or less the same place, won't it?
It should be more or less. It won't be exactly the same place.
If we have exactly the same frequency.
If you've got the pulse dead right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's...
That's a bloody pulse, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Should we go and ring Don up?
So we were absolutely hysterical with excitement, and it took us some time to start thinking coherently. I think John Cock was the one who called off first.
Let's move off that position and do somewhere else and see if we get the same thing. I hope to God this isn't some sort of artifact or instrumentation.
We moved the telescope a little bit off the star so that we wouldn't be looking at the star at all.
This is beginning observation number 20.
This time, a little pulse began to appear in the middle of the screen, and I think our hearts all fell then, because we were getting pulsations now from the place where it shouldn't be coming from. And we thought it really was some electronic artifact. And I don't think anything was said. Anyway, we stopped that run.
We changed the frequency so that the computer was not running synchronously with the pulsar.
This is beginning of observation number 21. To change your frequency setting to check the results of the three previous observations.
And so we did that, and then we found that there was no pulse there, as we would expect.
And I suggested, I think, that maybe we hadn't set the telescope off quite far enough and that some of the light was leaking around the corner. So we moved the telescope well off this time.
Off Bata's star, off somewhere in some other part of the nebula.
The observation beginning now is observation number 22. It's 0.75 millimeters north of SP star.
And we did that, and we discovered nothing, no pulse at all.
So that was good. And now the real crunch came as we moved the telescope back on the pulsar, we set the timing right, and...
This is observation number 23. It's a repeat of observation number 18 of this night.
Yeah.
Here she comes.
There?
I think so. Look, see, look at the hole at the bottom.
Ah, yes. Right, there it is. Lay down.
Wait a minute, he's building it right here now. There's definitely something here.
Yeah, there is, huh? What's that? Yeah, that's the one.
See, see the...
Mm-hmm.
Right, can we have the gain down? Yeah, it's building up nicely, look at that.
That's about the right spot for it, too, you know, we fiddle around all this time.
Is it? I don't know.
Yeah, it's gone,
well,
down
look,
and come
John,
back on the other side now.
No, well, you've altered that flipping
frequency. Oh, that's right. Well, it's there all right, isn't it? Look at it.
Look, John, there's definitely two pulses. See, look, they're split by a half cycle.
Right.
Well, that's just about... There couldn't be anything more definite than that, could you?
Keep it close. Come on, tape, hold out.
Have you rang out tape there?
Yeah.
Is there any room for the American National Anthem on this?
And then one of the things that passed through my mind, and that was, it seemed a terrible shame that Don Taylor wasn't there after he'd done so much towards it. So I went downstairs and rang him up. And I said, Don, we found the pulsar. And I could hear him sort of thinking things over in his mind and wondering what could possibly have gone wrong. But anyway, he made several suggestions, but he said he'd be up tomorrow to come and have a look for himself. But in the meantime, to keep fairly quiet about it. Well, we did a few more runs and convinced ourselves that we'd seen the pulsar, and then we rang our wives up.
Taylor was very skeptical. He was even more skeptical than I had been. And, of course, by then I was utterly convinced that we had it. And so what we did was we made just a continuing series of observations throughout the night of it, with the pulsar, in various colors and things like that. And then we closed up shop and went to bed, and then the next evening Taylor came up and we set things up again and did another run or two for him. And I think he probably did some more tests than himself. So but then he was convinced that what we had was the real thing.
And so we spent the rest of the night then trying to measure exactly where the pulses were coming from. It really was very close to Bata's star, but it might have been one of two stars in the middle of the nebula. And so we sent off a telegram then to the International Astronomical Union, which is a place where you've got a very exciting discovery which you want confirmed immediately, which you send it off to them and they send it to all observatories around the world. Well, what was really worrying us is we couldn't eliminate the possibility that we didn't know really which of the two stars in the middle of the nebula was the pulsar. We knew it was one of them, but we couldn't be absolutely sure. And to do that, we really needed a bigger telescope. And we realised now that having sent this telegram off, there'd be a lot of people working on the pulsar, and indeed it turned out that the people at Kitt Peak National Observatory itself, on the very same mountain, were going to work on it the following night too. There was a lot of interesting stuff to be done, and we weren't sure really how we were going to do any of it because we didn't have the right telescope. Well, we came to the conclusion that if we were going to find out which star it was, we're going to need a smaller diaphragm. That's a very small thing which can discriminate between one bit of the sky and the other. We had to do it before the next evening. So I remember we spent the whole day with some kitchen tin foil from the kitchen trying to make a tiny little hole in this thing about a tenth of a millimetre square. We finally succeeded in doing this, to everyone's amazement. We had, I can remember all four of us working on it, John, Don, Bob McAllister and myself. We had a microscope, which we'd found somewhere in the building, and we were looking through this microscope, this tiny piece of kitchen tin foil, working with pairs of tweezers and razor blades and so on. And when the guy who was making the actual cuts, I think John was actually doing the brain surgery, everybody held their breath tight after he drew a line and cut a line in the tin foil. But anyway, around about 5 o'clock, we finally had the diaphragm, which we gingerly placed into the telescope. And by this time, we'd had several phone calls from people either congratulating us or asking questions about the pulsar. We knew they were all going to work on it, so we felt it was a tremendous rush to get this thing and prove which star it was. It was kind of a race, you see. Well, as soon as it was dark, we set everything up, and Taylor had a damn clever idea. In order to find the pulsar exactly, he was going to find it by ear, by listening to his photometer. That's to say, he let the incoming light waves cause a microphone to make a little brrrr noise, and when we were on the pulsar, it would make a louder brrrr. And so Don would be sitting there in the dark with his ear against the microphone, while John and I were watching the screen, and Don would drive the telescope about fairly blindly around in the right position. When it got to the right position with his very tiny diaphragm, the brrrr would suddenly rise in tone, and we'd watch the scene to see if it was a pulsing source as well. And just about 8:30, 9 o'clock, we finally picked up one of the stars this way, and it had a pulse. We could see the pulse on the screen, and Don could hear it on the microphone, and we were positive now that it was the south preceding star. That's to say, Baader's original guess at the right star.
A couple of days later, after things had quieted down a little bit, our wives came up, and they cooked a special dinner for us with wine and things like that. And it was really, really all very, very, very cordial and very exuberant.
Yes, well, there was pandemonium up on the mountain after that. I don't think anything had been seen like it. We were having great big dinner parties with lots of wine and everything else and going up to observe. And every now and then, wives climbing up the stairs and peering between our shoulders to watch the screen. And Inge saying, "Claire, come and have a look. There's a lovely little pulse here. Hold it, John. Hold it, Mike." All very unprofessional. But anyway, it was exciting, and I wouldn't have missed it. I don't think science should become too solemn.
I was delighted when I heard a few days after the event, sometime middle of January 1969, that it was John Cock, Mike Disney, and Taylor who had found the optical pulsar. Because I still think it is fair to say that the discovery of the optical pulsar in the Crab Nebula is the best single discovery in optical astronomy in the past, well, since it happened. I don't know of any better. And it is charming because, as the tape explains, it was done by relative amateurs in optical astronomy. And I like that very much. Now, well, you have it in the radio. Why is it interesting you have it in the optical? Radio telescopes are typically not 200 inches, but 200 feet in diameter. And they have very powerful amplifying equipment. Therefore, the radio telescopes are really very much more sensitive in real energy terms than the optical telescopes. So if you see a pulsar in the optical from the same point in space from which you've heard a pulsar by radio, You have proved that it is making very much more light in the optical band than it is radio power in the radio band. And it turns out that that amount of energy which the Crab Nebula pulsar is pouring out is significant for its evolution. The pulsar in the Crab Nebula is slowing down. We know it's slowing down. But now we understand why it's slowing down, because it's giving out all that energy. The radio pulsar, you couldn't explain that by, because radio takes away no energy, but the optical light takes away very much more energy. And indeed, within a year or so after this, it was discovered by wonderful experiments with rocket work that it was not only a radio pulsar at the lowest energy, an optical pulsar, 10,000 times more energy than the radio, or 100,000 times, but even an X-ray pulsar, giving X-ray pulses, which are themselves about 10 or 100 times more powerful than the optical pulses. And this enormous emission of pulsed energy over all wave bands has given us an insight to a spinning neutron star. It is rather unusual that a man like John Cock and Mike Disney undertook to do experimental work. And of course, they were able to do that only because they had a very, very ingenious experimental colleague, Taylor, who had made the equipment that they were going to use. Their idea was how to use it, how to do an experiment with existing instruments on a new context that nobody had tried before, in order to find something that was plausibly suggested, but which many people disbelieved in and therefore did not have the energy to try. What you have to have in this kind of work, pioneer exploratory work, is what a friend of mine once called the necessary don't know how. You have to be able to trust your intuition or your hunch or your logic, which is not yet convincing, in spite of the expert's view, well, isn't very likely to happen.
We were incredibly fortunate. The first time we went observing, we had a very exciting experience like this. I don't think there could have been very many moments in astronomy when the immediacy of a discovery was so apparent. I mean, that it happened there it happened in real time.
It gave me a taste of what it's like to do something really, really exciting and interesting. And it also sort of brought me into the general feeling for what happens when you do something really good like that. After that, I became much more optimistic about things that I was doing and things that other people were doing, and I felt that really you only had to look in the right places and look often enough, and then you'd find something.
This is how I see astronomy. I think it's true of science in general. It's a form of big game hunting. You go off into some thicket or other, you think there's something big in there, you're not sure what it is, and you track it down. If it was primarily a cerebral activity, then people with first-class brains would be the people who are best at science. But I think that's very far from true. I think the most important thing, in my opinion at least, and I say this very humbly, because I mean, I think scientists are so different from one another, it's difficult to generalize. But I think the important thing is to want to get the answer, to really want to get the answer, to really come back with that trophy, as it were. That's far more important.
This unit was prepared by the Center for History of Physics of the American Institute of Physics. Work was funded by the United States National Science Foundation, the Heinemann Foundation, the Friends of the Center for History of Physics, and the American Institute of Physics.